Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins, and Kathleen, unfortunately, can't be with us today. Our special guest, however, today is with us, and his name is Scott Alan Roberts, and he is the person who has written a new book called The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and he is also the organizer of a beautiful conference called the Paradigm Symposium, which is being held in the second half of October, and he will talk shortly about that. I am very fortunate to be amongst the speakers there, as is the likes of Eric von Däniken, George Newry, Giorgio Tsoukalos, and various other good friends and people. So, Scotty, first of all, congratulations on the book, and thank you for putting in all the hard work in organizing a conference which is going to be a smashing success, and welcome to the Spirit Revolution.
Well, thank you, Philip. Thanks for having me, and thanks for all of that, and I really appreciate that.
I mean, first of all, let's begin with pointing out the obvious. Where is it, when is it, and what do people need to do to get to the symposium?
Well, it's in October of this year, October 18th through the 21st. It's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Now, that's in, for those of you who aren't quite familiar with the geography here, we're in north-central United States, and far be the notion that Minnesota is always a frozen tundra. It is the third weekend of October is usually beautiful. It's considered the prime fall color changing season for the leaves on the trees. And that weekend this last year was in the 80s, so it's Fahrenheit, so it's still pretty warm. Dispel the notion that it's always cold up here. It's a beautiful city. It's in the cultural corridor of the United States. And we are having our symposium, as you, Philip, already mentioned. You're going to be speaking there. We've got Eric von Däniken, who wrote Chariots of the Gods, one of the icons in the ancient astronaut field. We've got Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns, Ian Punnett, George Norrie. We've got several authors that you might be familiar with, from Laird Scranton to Nick Redfern to Marie D. Jones, Larry Flaxman, and several others that are going to be here. It's going to be a phenomenal event, and we're really looking forward to it. And there's two ways you can get there to the website to get tickets. You can go directly to paradigmsymposium.com, and paradigm, for those who might have a little difficulty with that word, that's P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M. I suppose over there in Great Britain they'll pronounce it paradigm. But paradigmsymposium.com, or simply go to my magazine site, intrepidmag.com, and there's a big link for Paradigm at the top.
Great. Now, let's get to who you are. And reading the back cover of The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, there was something which I thought was very interesting, because obviously the Nephilim are those creatures from the Bible. And it says here that you attended Bible school and theological seminary, working towards his master's in divinity. And then, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but basically you then took a completely different career move.
I did.
You went into advertising and publishing, which are two subjects which I think are very close to the Vatican Church, it has to be said.
Yes.
But first of all, why this interest and why this move away and why this book now?
Well, my interest was I got into – I was raised in a fairly agnostic home, and I got into evangelical Christianity when I was in my early teens. And I followed all the teachings and was very much a faithful believer in a very conservative, fundamental Baptist setting. And I went to Bible college after that and then right into seminary after that. I did not finish my degree. During the time, I was always an illustrator, an artist, a designer, and I was working through my latter high school days and college days and seminary days working in small print shops as an artist. And I had a good offer to be the creative director of an ad shop and when I was in seminary, and it was out of state, and I took it with all intentions of finishing my degree in another school. And I just never did. I ended up with a 30-year career in advertising and design and publishing and all of those things as a, primarily an illustrator and a designer. And a little bit of wordsmithery in there. And I published comic books when I was in the mid-80s and my late mid to late 20s. And that was some of my first writing forays and writing for comic books. And then I went just from there into eventually writing a novel, which ended up being a children's novel that I illustrated, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare. And it's an anthropomorphized tale set in Tudor England, Ireland, and Scotland. And it was just been a natural progression from there. And I drifted away, you could say, from the church and the teachings of the church I was in. Not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. I still hold to some of the basic tenets of my faith, but I struggle with those. I got to tell you, I'll be honest, Philip, on a faith level, I struggle with some things because faith to me is really difficult when the foundation, the factual foundations, seem to go in different directions. And so I still try to find a good common ground between those things, but I'm asking a lot more questions these days than I ever did when I was a kid.
But one of the questions you clearly asked yourself as a kid was one of the same questions which Eric von Däniken posed to himself when he was confronted with the Bible. And this is this affair of the Nephilim, the watchers, the giants of the Bible. And I guess my first question is, when I say watchers, when I say Nephilim, when I say giants, sometimes people assume this is all the same, that these are just different words to subscribe the same thing from the chapter in Genesis.
Right.
Or is that not the case? Are we really talking about various different being strands which somehow have been brought together for ease's sake?
Yes. First misnomer I find out there is when people talk about the Nephilim, they talk about them as being, oh, they're fallen angels, aren't they? Or they are a race that came down and impregnated human women. And I said, no, the Nephilim, by definition, at least theologically, and that's where my starting point was in the book of Genesis and the Hebrew Bible, the Nephilim are the offspring. They are merely the race that was created, and at least by the Hebrew version of the story. In the Genesis account, you've got the sons of God, the Bnei HaElohim, that came down and intermingled with the daughters of human. There is that stark contrast made in the Hebrew between the sons of God and the daughters of men. Then you have the book of Enoch, which is an apocryphal book because under the councils of Constantine, that was found to be one of the books of the Bible that they felt was not canonical or not scriptural, so it was booted out. Yet I find that it was quoted many times in the Old Testament, many times in the New Testament, even by Jesus himself. And I used to say, rather tongue-in-cheek, if it was good enough for Jesus to quote, then it's scripture enough for me. That was the way I looked at the book of Enoch. But you go to these sources. In Enoch, he talks about the watchers being the similar beings as the sons of God in Genesis. But then you have to take a big step outside the box. And if you are Judeo-Christian in your belief system, you're going to find that these are things that will challenge your faith, because when you step outside the box and you start to look at all of culture, human culture, you will find that there are over 600 different ancient cultures that speak about beings that came down to the earth that impregnated human women, per se, and bequeathed a race. And many times these are linked to all these other religious mythologies about flood accounts. And this was, by the way, when I was in seminary and Bible college and church, I was never taught that the story of the Nephilim was connected to the story of Noah and the Ark, which they are. They're inextricably connected. And everything that happens in and between, before and afterwards, there's a big picture of the Hebrew version of these events. So I like the one prime example I like to go to is the Tuatha De Danann. You go into the Celtic mythologies, ancient Celtic, the Iberian Peninsula, and they talk about the bright shining kings who came down from heaven and intermingled with humans and taught forbidden knowledges. And they were the Tuatha De Danann, the children of the goddess Danu. And these bright shining creatures, these bright shining kings from heaven, they were called, were also known later as the elven folk who receded into the hollow hills. So it already went into our other mythologies right there. But you look at the beings themselves, the bright shining aspect of them, and you find them also mentioned in the Genesis account, in the biblical account, in the Enochian account, and in several other accounts. And it spans from creation families to bloodlines that were the offspring of these beings to beings that a divine being in all these different cultures wanted to wipe out for one reason or another, and it ended up in many times in the flood story, in the flood accounts. So these beings are not isolated to Hebrew scripture, to the Old Testament, to the Bible itself. They are found in many, many, many cultures out there.
And while we're talking about all of these different names, are we talking about the same beings, the same kind of species of beings, or are they really all different names for different beings, or at least we have no idea whether they're one and the same?
I started out by saying that we have no real way of telling. All of this stuff, none of it is provable beyond a shadow of a doubt. There are some, it's like with religion and spirituality, there are some veils you can't pierce. You can't prove whether or not a God exists. The same with these. You can see evidences, just like in all the work that you do, Philip. There's lots of evidences out there for many things, but finding ways to prove them beyond a shadow of a doubt so they are accepted, say, mainstream, is the difficult task here. These beings, I believe, were all representations of similar beings, maybe one caste of beings that affected ancient human history, non-human entities that came down and intermingled or interfered in some interpretations with human affairs and with the development of humanity. Were they all the same race? I don't know. I think when you see all these different stories really linking together these common threads, you can start to surmise that maybe all these different cultures are referring in their stories to the same progression of events and the same people, the same beings. But it's very possible that you're talking about many different kinds of races because they do have their similarities, but they also have their differences.
And, I mean, there's various, I think, traditions which kind of like do make distinctions between these beings. And some of it, I think, is based on logic. For example, when you say that there were these beings, the what I would say the father of the Nephilim, who mated with humans, that suggests a very physical being, a being which to some extent is compatible with our genes for them to create offspring. And then when you go into the fairy realm, we have this notion that they are more nebulous, more other dimensional, not really so flesh and blood. So where do you stand on that? What are the insights you've gained into that?
Well, I have found that there are all different kinds of beings that we have relegated to the realm of mythology. And if I can jump just ahead and I'll come right back to this, I think some of that could be attributed to perhaps a collective consciousness of either misinformation, disinformation, a clouded memories that were given, encoded messages that are there. Some of these things we don't remember as clearly as we would like, and there aren't as many records for them. Getting back to this idea of these different beings, I believe that there are these spirit beings, for lack of a better way to describe them, that those more ethereal beings that delve or dwell in that ethereal realm. You look at the fairy folk, per se, the fae, and I use the Celtic definition of them there. They are considered to be a spirit caste, an elemental caste that is there. Did they impregnate humans? No, I don't think they did, but they interact and interweave throughout human history. So I think you can look at these things from a spiritual angle, and you can look at these things from a totally detached from spirituality angle, one that says, I believe that there is very possibly different races that are here either from within the earth that are interdimensional beings such as the Fae, who are also called, you also have your elementals, though, who are elemental to the earth itself. You have your reptilian beings that are always talked about throughout mythology as being from within the earth. You have your, let's go right to the Anunnaki. in the ancient Sumerian culture, which is a race that came down and supposedly enslaved hominids and inbred in them a higher intelligence. So you have all these different kind of beings. So my simple answer to your question would be absolutely yes. I think that there is a difference between the beings that can be identified as the Nephilim type, which are the physical impregnators, the physical enactors, intercoursers, if you will, from those that are the spirit beings or the elemental beings or the things that interact on this earth that we've just, in modern society, we've brushed that all aside and we've pushed it away and said it doesn't exist. And I think that's why it has fallen into the realm of mythology and fairy book or fairy tale. But I think they are very real beings that interact and coexist with us.
So let's try and scrape them off that great dustbin and bring them back into the realm as much as we can of reality, starting with what seems to be the easiest, but maybe turning out to be the hardest one to prove, which is obviously creatures which are deemed to be physical. First question, where do these come from?
Well, there's several sources. And again, some of this depends on your starting point, but then you can't always stay with your starting point. You have to morph as you start to gain information. You have to grow with it. The basic study of my book was to go into the Hebrew theology. This is what I was raised in, what I was taught, and I wanted to examine what they were within the pages of Scripture, Old Testament Scripture. And so you have in Genesis these beings called the sons of God, the Bene HaElohim. The book of Enoch describes the same beings as the Watchers, and that they descended to the earth and they chose human women. So it doesn't say they were androgynous in any way. It says that they were all at least took on the form of male, physical male characters, because it doesn't say there were any females among them, and that these males interbred with humans and taught them forbidden knowledges. And this was the story even as far back as the biblical Genesis account of the Garden of Eden, that the reptilian character there, who has always been religiously referred to as Lucifer or Satan or the devil, he's never called that in the text. He's referred to as Nakosh, the trickster, the crafty one, the magician, the bringer of knowledge, the bright shining one, who correlates with later places in Scripture, the divine council, who were called the bright shining princes of heaven. And this is who I believe the sons of God were, the watchers were. They were, at least in that religious or spiritual realm, according to the book of Genesis, they would have been this divine council, this cast of and not to offend anybody's religious sensibilities, but I don't believe the Bible teaches monotheism. You've got Elohim, the singular God, referring to them as the caste of Elohim, the gods of heaven. And these are the ones who descended down. Now, that would, I believe, be your scriptural answer to that. That is the source point for them there. And that's where the source of the word Nephilim comes from. They are the offspring of this intercourse, is the race of the Nephilim. And then you start going into other cultures, and you will find, or even anthropological studies, and you will start to find that there are beings mentioned all through history that interbred with humans, that brought knowledge to humans. You find them in some of the more outstanding versions. I talked about the Celtic version with the Tuatha. You can look at Krishna, who was the bringer of forbidden knowledges to human beings. He sat on a coiled serpent beneath a tree and disseminated knowledge and information. You can look at the Indian versions of the gods that came down, of the beings that came down and intermingled with humans and brought knowledges and even battled with each other. And so I think it depends on your beginning point, but then your beginning point is going to morph as you go out there. I came into all of this with a very, what I feel, solid Christian faith behind what I believed. But the more I started digging into ancient sources and different races, different cultures that talked of these different races, I found, wait a minute, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Was Jehovah and the Genesis account all that was there, all that there was, and everybody built off of that? Or did the more ancient cultures have a story that was much older than the Genesis account? And is there a true evolution or etymology of religion that built off of these common things? So if I've gotten anywhere close to answering your question on that, I think you can have a spiritual angle, and you can have one where you try to, not for any negative purpose, but eradicate yourself a bit from the religious aspect so you can look at the other spiritualities and the other physical evidences that might be there, or historical evidences.
And so these creatures are born, the offspring of these beings, and we'll come back to them, and earthly females. And where do we find them? Where do they live? What happens to them?
Well, according to, and again, I'll hail back quite often to my study in Genesis, because that's where I started off with this. And what you find is that they were a race that, according to the Hebrew religion, brought corruption and wickedness to mankind, and therefore God was going to wipe them out and do it with a great deluge, a great flood. And he chose, at least the way we were taught the story, the one righteous man, Noah, to build an ark and to save the animals two by two and so on. We know the story that exists there. Yet the English version of that is different than the Hebrew version. When you start digging into the encoded text, you will find Noah isn't at all referred to as a righteous man. He's referred to as the pure-blooded man, one who is pure in all his generations. And there was a point behind that phrase, pure in all his generations, back to the beginning. And you will find that according to the biblical account, God wiped out this race with the great flood. However, it was an ineffectual wiping out, because even the verses where you find them in Genesis 6 says that they were on the earth during that time and also afterward. And then you find several references to the Nephilim throughout the Old Testament, that they existed. You've got Enoch telling us that the ghosts or the spirits of the Nephilim who died in the great deluge, because they were born on the earth, they are bound to the earth, and they will forever in spirit form be bound to the earth and plague mankind as they did prior to the flood, only in spirit form for all time. So that is the Genesis account you have. You have the accounts in the Anunnaki, the Sumerian culture, with the Anunnaki, the freedom fighters like Enki, Ea, who came down and liberated the enslaved humans, and was then he and his followers were forever cast, that god race, into the inner dwellings of the earth, the subterranean caverns, and so that they were to dwell forever in the earth. So what happened to the Nephilim? It depends on whose version you're reading. It seems that there is always a judgment passed on them of some kind, be it a religious judgment or a governmental type of judgment from the hierarchy. And they are left to dwell on this planet, on this place, and to live and operate here. And you know as well as I do, even now, you can trace some of the bloodlines of these things and some of the history of these things, the cultural religious stories. And by the way, that's something that I always say, we don't separate out. People say, well, you can't believe that. That was written in a book of faith, a religious book. Well, keep in mind, most ancient cultures did not divide religion from history, from cultural events. They were all wrapped up together, and that's how they recorded things, because life was about the way the gods treated them, or the way the spiritual interacted with humanity. And it's, you can even see more current examples of that, if you will, if you just look to things like the reign of Elizabeth I of England or Henry VIII, how they linked their spirituality about Catholicism or Protestantism with all their edicts and their royal decrees. Same with the witch trials in early America in the 1600s. You will find the same thing, how much religion and faith governed the morality and the governing bodies of the politic of the day. So all of these things, no matter how you look at them, they've got these beings still existing here, whether they've receded like the Tuatha De Danann, receded as the elven folk into the hollow hills, or whether they have been cast down like Lucifer and Satan and his fallen angels, or the elementals and the fairies who, according to Roman Catholic theology, were too good for hell but too bad for heaven, so they were given the earth as their realm. All of these beings are somehow, you find them being relegated to the earth, and with some rare exceptions.
Which kind of like means that in the eyes of these beings, Earth was kind of an okay place, but not necessarily your favorite holiday destination.
right.
Which kind of like begs, I mean, like a side question to me. Like when we're talking about these Nephilim, they clearly want to come to Earth to play with our female women. But then when they're stuck here, when their kind of the decree is issued against them that they have to stay here, they sort of seem to be quite upset about it, or at least it's passed as a negative judgment against them. So it almost seems as if you have beings who pop in and out of worlds. Is that a fair impression?
I think that's a fair impression. And this is a good spot. I want to talk about the Divine Council in Psalm 82, where you've got God under the name of Elohim, which is the name for God used about 3,000 times in the Old Testament. Elohim, El, by the way, being the name for God, which, as you know, is really the evolutionary etymology of El Elil from the ancient Sumerian culture 3,000 years earlier. But it says in Psalm, it says, "And Elohim stood in the midst of the Elohim," a singular, standing in the midst of a plural, "and he," singular, "said to them," plural, "you are all Elohim, the gods of heaven, the bright shining princes." And then he says, "But I could strip your immortality from you and you will die like men." And he goes on to this big judgment of them. So, yes, you always seem to have this judgmental effect that's coming on, this race that is relegated, or not even relegated, they are condemned to stay here on this place, in the bowels of this planet. And it's funny when you read the Enochian version of the Watchers who came down. They're all saying, and it names them by name, and it says there were 200 of them, and they were all making this pact as they descended to the slopes of Mount Armon, which is Mount Hermon in northern Israel in the Golan Heights today. And they came there, and they made this pact to go in amongst human women. And their leader, Shemyaza, said, "Don't do this, we're going to get in big trouble." And they basically thumbed their noses at him and said, "We're doing this anyway because we want to do this. You're either with us or against us." And so Shemyaza joined them. Then they went into human women. And so it seemed to be a thing that they all wanted to do. But again, if you go to the Sumerian culture and look at the Anunnaki, they were a race that came here for a purpose of perhaps refining mining out a natural resource. And according to that version, enslaved hominids, and but then those who freed them were the ones that were condemned to stay here forever. So I believe that there is a quality to all of this. This is a visited place, but like you said, perhaps the vacation place. It's like saying, do you want to live in on an island in the Northern Hebrides off the coast of Scotland? It'd be a great place to visit, but do you want to make a home there forever? Maybe, maybe not. And I think this is what this was like. And then as far as the spiritual element of this, or the spirit being of this, the interdimensional being, if you will, I believe that there is the doorways that open and close. A friend of mine, Craig Hines, wrote a great book, The Gateway of the Gods. And he talks in great extent about the interdimensionality of these beings who could come and go as they please. And I think even when you delve over into your paranormal realm and people are getting recordings of voices talking to them and things like this and things that they experience, I think you are tapping into some things. When you get messages on your tape recorder that say, set your frequency to such and such so we can hear you better, is that a ghost talking to you, or is that a voice? Is that something interdimensional? So there is a great interdimensional doorway quality to all of this.
And when we're talking about this interdimensional gateway, it's been described by various people. Ancient civilizations have spoken about it. There was one aspect of heaven through which the souls came, another aspect of heaven through which the dead souls went. Do we have to interpret it in that setting, or are we talking about a different setting here when it comes to everything to do with the Nephilim?
I think that the Nephilim have a very physical, three-dimensional aspect to them. But where they came from, their forebears, I think it's like Stephen Hawking would say, there are nine dimensions. And And they're finding more and more, I guess. It's like finding more planets out there in our solar system. We keep discovering more aspects to dimensionality. So if I'm answering your question correctly, I think that the source point of these beings is definitely interdimensional. You may have, when you look at the universe and you say that there are billions of galaxies out there that each hold billions of stars that could have billions of solar systems in each one, you're looking at an exponential number of physical places that beings could come and visit us from. Is the likelihood that these are beings from another planet that came here in spaceships? Perhaps, maybe. There are some scant references that we interpret as being spaceships in a lot of these old writings. Is it more likely that they are interdimensional, that they come here from another place? Again, I think it's looking at the quality of the visitations that we've seen down through the millennia and the recent centuries, even the recent generation. You see a lot of visitations that take place that I think some are hack and some are false and frauds or psychological banter. But some of what is real out there, I think you're finding things that aren't always as physical as we think they are. So if I'm answering your question correctly here, I think, yes, there is an interdimensional quality even to the physical interactions that we have.
Now, you bring up the modern component. And in your book, in fact, I'm looking at it here on page 95, you draw a very simple comparison, but I think a very interesting comparison, to the fact that Mount Hermon, which is where these watchers basically took an oath to stick around, is on the same parallel, 30 degrees north, as Roswell, New Mexico. Is it a coincidence or is there far more to it?
I have come to believe in my adult life that there is no such thing as coincidence. And coincidence is only coincidental if it happens. not to be double talking there, but I don't think that there's anything that happens by chance. I made that comparison because it linked directly to the Watchers or the Sons of God who came down to the earth, that they descended to the slopes of Mount Hermon, which sits, straddles the border between Syria and Lebanon and the Golan Heights today, a mountain that sits on the 33rd parallel north, but the exact spot, the global opposite spot on the 33rd parallel is the very famous controversial pop cultural even crash site of the UFOs at Roswell, New Mexico, about 70 years ago. And the big question you have to ask is this a coincidence that these things line up along this line and are opposites on the globe? Is this a coincidence or is there something to this? I spoke with one of your cohorts, Bill Burns, about this, and he said that he believes that the 33rd parallel was a way line for extraterrestrial air traffic, for UFO traffic, ancient alien traffic, if you will. And you know as well as I do, with all the studies that you do on sacred sites around the world, especially there in the British Isles, you know how so many of these sacred sites out of our ancient past seem to coincide with other ancient sites. They line up along grids, call them ley lines, if you will, call them some kind of an ancient grid system that seemed to line things up. Cultures that were seemingly non-connected in our ancient pasts by global travel are somehow lined up all along. I was very recently taken by the circular Nordic structures, ancient Nordic structures that were found in, I believe it was from Norway to Finland, somewhere up in there. But there was four of them in particular that seemed to line up in a straight line, which when you continue the straight line southward, you end up at the Oracle of Thebes, or the Oracle of Delphi, I'm sorry, in Greece, and that line continues on straight down to the Giza Plateau. So when you start having quote-unquote coincidences like this, that tells me that there is something greater at play here. There was something with more design and more structure to it. When all these things start lining up with all these different cultures that have all these different gods, as they called them, or these beings, this is where you start seeing the differentiation between all these different beings, yet all these things having these similar threads and these similar lining up lines all around the globe, this grid work. So that to me is no coincidence. And it's, can I explain it per se? No, I can talk about it and I can speculate. I can surmise. Can we prove that's what it is? No, but it certainly looks like that.
So we are talking here about beings who were around at some point in the past, maybe the cradle of mankind itself, maybe responsible for the cradle of mankind, but also apparently around today. And one of the things which greatly intrigued me in the, I would say, the first half of the 1990s was a series of books by a UFO researcher called Raymond Fowler. He documented principally one UFO abduction case of a woman called Betty Andreasen Luca. And towards the end of his research into this case, he gave two books in that series, the name The Watchers, and then the successor to that, The Watchers 2. And basically what he came away with was this identification that the beings responsible for Betty's abductions, which were pretty much your typical gray, alien, short, almond eyes kind of creature, were the same as the Watchers. And he came away with this because of certain details which she remembered when she was in basically on their ships, one away from her body. Some of these encounters were actually more astral rather than physical. But he began to study and kind of like look into the details of some of the things they were saying to her sometimes when she asked them. And he absolutely came away convinced that what was happening to her, the creatures which were abducting her, were the same who had been described in the Bible thousands of years before. And Raymond is not the only one who has that opinion. You've come across other people who basically share that same idea.
Yes, there was within evangelical Christianity itself, a man named Chuck Missler has written some books on the alien grays and how they link into the Nephilim of the Bible or the Watchers of the Bible. I've got a book sitting over here on my shelf that I haven't completed, but it's called The Unholy Communion. And I can't remember who the authors are off the top of my head, and it's way over in the back of my office here. I can't see it, but their whole take is that the alien grays link into demonology, and this is how you can explain demonology, or the other way around, how you can explain the alien grays from a biblical standpoint. And they're dealing in their book with many cases of people that are, they call, bound by all of this psychologically. So I don't recall in the book of Genesis or in the book of Enoch physical descriptions of these beings as looking like alien grays. They do talk about them being men and that they were somewhat pleasing to the eye of human women. But you do have your ancient Sumerian culture and many other cultures which have depictions in their iconography or their statuary, or their relics, their little clay relics. You will find, especially the Sumerian culture, things that have similar appearance to what we would classify as the alien grays. I don't want to say that people who have those experiences, astral experience, that they're faking it or that it's not real. I'm just saying it's harder for me to quantify that. For me, a man who's coming out of faith in a religion, very solid faith when I was a younger man. Again, it's another thing that lines up as something that I can believe only because somebody said so. I want to know what these experiences are, and I want to know how to quantify them. Now, maybe some of these astral experiences can be quantified when you start looking into other data. And apparently, as you mentioned, Fowler seemed to line up some of these things. I think you have all the, as I mentioned earlier already, the statuary and the carvings and the all these relics from ancient cultures that seem to indicate there were beings that had this general appearance. And are we speculating when we line those all up, or are we saying, look, this is evidences from all over the place that these beings existed, and we've got it right here. It's just getting beyond the unbelievable factor of it and being able to quantify it.
And I guess that's actually where my next question is going, because we've got material in the Bible, and whether you are a Christian or even a biblical fundamentalist, you kind of accept the fact that these things are real. But I don't think even a biblical fundamentalist is knowledgeable or aware of the fact that there might be this extreme presence here, that we are not alone, that this is not just something which happened thousands of years ago, but that this has a component to this very day. You've pointed at so many cultures which report these encounters. The UFO phenomenon, to a large extent, and specifically in Bud Hopkins' interpretation, was very much a kind of hybrid creation, sexual continuation, procreation kind of encounter between two species. It seems to be everywhere, yet you're the only one who's sort of writing a book about it, and I don't mean that at all discouraging. In fact, what I'm hinting at is, why is not more written about this? Why is this not more prominently discussed? Because even the likes of Eric von Däniken, when he was young, was very much interested in this. Zechariah Sitchin traces it back to the same thing. I might even go and say that millions of young kids are enamored or question this idea of these angels who, whether you call them the fallen angels, it doesn't really matter, of these beings coming to Earth and having these things with human females. Why is it not more prominent?
I think the basic reason you will run into is because you begin to tread into the area of taboo for so many religious and spiritual cultures and belief systems. Let me just stick to evangelical Christianity. If I bring these things up with some of my old seminary buddies or people, old pastors of mine, and we talk about this stuff, what you're delving into is something then that will make them rethink the dogmas of their theology. And somebody asked me a question the other day about what do I think of all these religions that have been rising up out of these ancient cultures and ancient alien beliefs and so on. And I said, there's a danger right there, because once you start creating a religion, you have to establish a dogmatic point of view. And when you establish dogma, dogma is usually the thing that is undeniable and cannot be, from within that religion's confines, be questioned or be changed or altered. It's not a growing thing. A dogma is an established train of thought. Dogma is what led the Inquisition and many other things, because they said you fall outside Galileo, you fell outside dogma of the church, and therefore was condemned for it. So I think the big problem you face with any of this stuff not taking hold in religion, in religious circles, is, or mainstream religions, is because it falls outside the dogmas. When you start to say, perhaps these beings mentioned in Genesis were not angels or angelic at all, which, by the way, in the text, the Hebrew word for angel never appears. But when these beings appear there, who are they? And if you say that there is a race that bequeathed intelligence to human beings, or a race that brought another race to humankind, that falls outside the accepted dogmas of faith. And I will find, I even mentioned in my book, friends that I know, people in evangelical Christianity are very curious about these things. But once you bring them to a point of where they say, wow, that's just a little too far, they will turn it off completely. I had an old seminary professor of mine, very good man, named Dr. Charles Ayling. He was a geologist, an archaeologist, an Egyptologist. When I was in the eighth grade in school in the 70s, I went to him because I was doing a report on Amenhotep II, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and I asked him about it. And so I've known this man for years. He was the president of my seminary, and he has now been the chair of history at Northwestern College in Minnesota for the last 25 years. And this is a man who was conservative, fundamentalist, Baptist in his setting. He was the man who first told me, now a very old notion, back in the early 80s, he said, all mythology has it at its headwaters a kernel of truth from which you build. And that was new thought to me back then. But I talked to him, and he is somebody who says, when we were talking about the Nephilim a few months back, he said, I have grown to believe that they are anything but human. He says, they are non-human entities. What they are, I can't exactly tell you. He said, but, and this is on point here, he says, I can't quite yet go so far as to accept ancient alien theory. And he kind of left it at that. It's not that he doesn't think about it, and not that he doesn't consider it. It's that it does not fit into the framework of what he has been doing his whole life and the dogmatic system he's in. So I think the reason you don't see more of this coming out, take it outside of religion, by the way, in archaeology, mainstream science, they eschew the notion that there is anything like an ancient alien theory. And if they at all accept it, they cannot say it out loud because they will lose peer review or they will not be accepted within their scientific or archaeological circles or anthropological circles. And so they have to keep those things private because those things are forbidden. You cannot go into the realms that require any modicum of faith or guesswork or spirituality to believe that they might exist. In my book, I take to task evolutionary science. Now, I'm not saying evolution didn't take place in humankind, but look at the ascendancy of evolutionary ascendancy of humankind. We've got all these different stages that are identified, and they keep identifying other stages, but they still don't have the missing link. There is no DNA connection between any of them. There is nothing that links them. But science will tell you they are all connected. We just can't link them yet. And what is that really? That is science acting collectively in scientific faith. Although they will not call it that, they believe that this is so, therefore they operate under that dogma. And when you have guys like Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, coming out and saying religion and spirituality are trash, quote unquote, yet he believes in the evolutionary ascendancy of man by filling in the gaps with his own version of faith. In a sense, what you're doing is when you're wiping out one faith and saying you can't believe that because it's all science and it's all this dogma over here, he is establishing science as the surrogate for religion and faith. And in a sense, science becomes the new religion. So all of this stuff, the answer to your question in this is I think it doesn't get looked at biblically or through Christian eyes or for religious circles, mainstream anyway, and the same with science and archaeology and anthropology because it treads on that taboo ground that says thou shalt not go here. You have to stay within the facts of what we can define within quantifiable science. And some of these things that we believe and we work in and realize are probably true are because we have the ability, I think, to think beyond that box. Even though there are veils that cannot be pierced, you have to think outside the box to draw any kind of conclusion on any of this.
It's almost as if the Nephilim dare to go where they were told not to go, and the same thing seems to be for scientists, that they need to go somewhere where they don't really want to go. And I think if science goes there, the effects will be better than the Nephilim's fate. You touched upon it just ever so slightly, but one question I have is this. Nephilim and angels, fallen angels, all the same, different?
Different, not the same at all. Nephilim, while they have a definition to them that speaks, that can lend itself to a fallen aspect, the Nephilim, remember, are not the descended ones. They are the offspring of the mixture or the intermingling of the descended sons of God or watchers mixing with human women, and the descendants are the earthbound Nephilim. They are half and half. They are demigods, if you will. They could not ascend to the heavens. They could not, I don't believe they had the ability to do the things that their fathers did. They were earthbound in nature. And as Enoch said, after death, they are still earthbound because they were born on the earth and proceeded from the earth, from minglings on the earth. And so, the watchers, the Bene HaElohim, the sons of God, they're the ones that descended down. They're the ones that came from elsewhere. Where that place is, we don't know exactly. It depends on your starting point and what you want to believe about where they came from. But their offspring were definitely earthbound. So angels, the word angel never appears in the text. They are never, the watchers and the sons of God are never defined as angelics, as slipping my mind now, melikos or melik. I can't think of the Hebrew word for angel off the top of my head for some reason at the moment. But that word never appears in the text. They are called in the biblical text, they are called the Bene Ha-Elohim. They are the sons of God or the bequeathed of God. They are the bright shining ones of heaven. They are the polytheistic cast of heaven. If you will, they are like the, think of the Olympian gods where you had Zeus as the head god and everybody else was underneath him, beneath him. But they were all a cast of gods. I think this is where your pantheons of gods all start to link into the story in the Old Testament. The Old Testament does not teach monotheism. It teaches that there is a god that was maybe more superior than the others, that had some dominion over the others, but that this is where they came from. And they were not angels. There is no place in the text anywhere. They've been called fallen angels because of the word Nephilim. Nephilim, the base Hebrew word of Nephal, to fall, to come down, to descend, for one to leave one's estate and go to another. The heem is the plural suffix in the Hebrew, denoting plurality. Those who fell, those who came down, those who left their estate. And I think what that is referring to is not the parentage. It's not referring to those who came down initially, the Bene Ha-Elohim. It's referring to the fallen state or the corrupted state of the Nephilim, as the Bible account and the Enochian account likes to tell us, that they were corrupt and wicked and they caused the fall of mankind.
Now, a hybrid race known as the Nephilim who once lived upon this planet, is there any chance, any indication, any evidence, any proof in the archaeological record? Is there a skeleton? Is there a tradition? Or is this really, at this moment in time, all to be taken on the writings rather than any, what I would say, touchable hard evidence in this, in the sense of bones and other kinds of structure?
I think you have mythologies all throughout ancient mankind of giants in the earth. You have biblical mythologies of giants that existed. Skeletal remains are so scant as to say they're almost non-existent. All the pictures you see on the internet and things like that, I believe there's not a single one of those that is a genuine photograph. Albeit there are museums, and it slips my mind at the moment which museum carries some of the skulls that they don't put on display, but these large skulls that actually, when you measure out, end up being anywhere between 9 and 12 feet tall, some of these beings, if you do the math on them. So I don't think we have remains that we can readily go to and say, see, here are the remains of the Anunnaki, or here are the remains of the Nephilim. I don't think you can find that and have them identified as such. I think you have remains that are so scant in number and so unquantifiable that they don't know what they are, and you can plug the meaning in, but you don't know for sure. It's also with this whole idea of these races being found in other places, even in the Bible. You look at the famous story of David and Goliath. It talks about Goliath of Gath and that he was a giant. And later in the Old Testament, during the deeds of David, you find that Goliath had three brothers, and they were the four brothers of Gath, and they were all called the children of Anak, the Nephilim. And Goliath, by the height given in the Bible, 6 cubits in a span, was roughly 9 foot to 10 foot tall, in that range of depending on what your cubit was, which was the length of a man's elbow to his fingertips. So depending on how tall you were, I suppose it would depend on how tall your cubit was. But so you find these scant mentions of them in other places throughout Scripture. You find the children of Israel, when they come out with Moses under the Exodus, go to the land of Canaan. And they don't want to go into Canaan because the spies come back telling them, oh, the Nephilim, the children of Anak are there. Their giants were grasshoppers in their sight. Now, it's interesting that the only place you find the Nephilim, the word Nephilim being translated as giant is erroneous. Doesn't mean that at all. It talks about the fallen. where you find giant is where the Genesis passage says, and the Nephilim were on the earth in those days. They were known as the Nephilim, the heroes of old and the men of renown. And the men of renown was language in the Hebrew language referring to the Giborim, a Hebrew class of giants, if you will. If they were even literal giants, doesn't say. They were giants because they were the men of renown, the great heroes of old, the mighty valorous warriors and things like that. And it's very interesting that even Goliath, in the account of David and Goliath, is referred to as a mighty man of valor from the days of his youth. And so that was sometimes code language for giants within the biblical text. They may have been literal giants by the measure of Goliath and, of course, King Og and references like that in the Bible. And then, of course, mythology. If all mythology has some truth at its headwaters, you've got all the stories of giants throughout all different kinds of cultures, from Sumerian culture to Arabian culture to Nordic culture to Celtic culture, there were giants. Even the Tuatha De Danann were said to be the giant or the very tall, bright, shining kings from heaven. So giants existed. Do we have skeletal remains? If we do, it would take a lot of study and a lot of extrapolating of data to make it fit.
But even without that, Scotty, I think you have done a remarkable job. You definitely have taken up the challenge and have risen to the occasion to talk about the fallen angels. And your book is The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, The Untold Story of Fallen Angels, Giants on the Earth, and Their Extraterrestrial Origins. You are, of course, Scott Allen Roberts. You have written this book, which is just out by New Page Books. And you are also the organizer of a conference which I will be attending and one of the speakers of. And if you could just give our listeners a quick overview of when that conference is, as well as where to find you and your book.
Absolutely. Well, the Paradigm Symposium, you can go to paradigmsymposium.com and see all about it. It is going to be held October 18th through the 21st of this year in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can go to our website and find out how to buy tickets there. And you can see all the fantastic, phenomenal speakers we have, which, by the way, Philip, I want to thank you again for coming on board with the symposium. I am thoroughly taken aback and impressed by the caliber of people who have said, yes, they would like to be part of this event, you included. And we have Eric Von Daniken, George Norrie, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns, Ian Punnett, Laird Scranton, Dr. John Ward, archaeologist from Egypt, Marie D. Jones, Larry Flaxman, Nick Redfern, and several other people that you'll want to take a look at. So you can go to intrepidmag.com and click on the Paradigm Symposium link and see all about it.
Thanks, Scotty, for being our guest on this week's episode of The Spirit Revolution. We will be back next week with another show, but until then, from Kathleen and myself, the truth against the world.